Good evening. You'll turn over with me to Daniel chapter 1. Daniel chapter 1. When I was trying to pick people, I knew I wanted to do an object lesson, and there were three that kept coming to mind, and they all sort of went together in a way for me. And so I want to talk about Daniel, Nehemiah, and Jeremiah, and I wanted to use these three men as object lessons here, and we're going to take certain lessons from these men, and as we go through this, I want you to think about some of the practical. We're going to get into practical lessons here as we go through each man, but just while we're reading and before we really get into the practical side of things, I want you to think for yourself about what are some practical lessons that I might take. And hey, if they happen to be the same that I have up here, great. But if not, then that's more that you can take with you as you go home today. But I wanted to pick these three men for some very particular reasons that hopefully we'll catch on as we go through here. So let's start with Daniel. We're going to be looking at Daniel chapter 1. And we're going to start from verses, we're not going to read all of 18 through 21, but I want us to focus here in the beginning on verse 8, and then we're going to skip down to the end here. But Daniel made up his mind that he would not defile himself with the king's choice food or with the wine which he drank. So he sought permission from the commander of the officials that he might not defile himself. Now God granted Daniel favor and compassion in the sight of the commander of the officials. And the commander of the officials said to Daniel, I'm afraid of my lord the king who has appointed your food and your drink, for why should he see your faces looking more haggard than the youths who are your own age? Then you would make me forfeit my head to the king. Daniel said to the overseer whom the commander of the officials had appointed over Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, please test your servants for 10 days and let us be given some vegetables to eat and water to drink, and then let our appearance be observed. And through the course of this, we find that their faith pays off. I want you to go down to verse 20 and 21. As for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and conjurers who were in all his realm. And Daniel continued until the first year of Cyrus the king. We're not 100% sure how old Daniel is at this point. But he would have been in his late teens or early 20s at this point when the land of Judah is taken captive by Babylon and they're sent by groups into Babylon. So he's a young guy. He's in a new place, doesn't really know a lot of what's going on. His land was just ransacked. We're not really sure what happened to his family. But what we see here is, starting in verse 8, it says, but Daniel made up his mind. And even later when he says, look, I think you're kind of forfeiting my own life here, Daniel says, basically, you know what? My faith is a bit stronger than that. And so he, after making up his mind, sticks to his guns. And guess what? Everything turns out well for him. And Daniel enjoys a lot of time in high positions of authority, very similarly to Joseph. So the first lesson that I want us to look here, and it says that as for every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king consulted them, he found them 10 times better. I'm not sure how you quantify that, but I'm sure that 10 here is probably not an official number. But they're showing wisdom that should ultimately be beyond their years. So there's something going on here with Daniel. And so the first lesson that I want us to take from Daniel this afternoon is that we're never too young. We're never too young to make up our minds to be like God or to have faith in God. There's no age limit to that. And because of that, it starts to work out well for Daniel. And Daniel is able to overcome many challenges that face him. The fact that he manages to survive so many regime changes alone is a pretty amazing feat. But here, he's made up his mind. As we talked earlier about, you know, the tearing down of our faith, recognizing that this is a perfect opportunity, right? There is a man who is telling him, look, this is something you have to do, or else, basically. And God had his ear, and he let Daniel get away with this, and it worked out well. But here, Daniel made sure that his faith was where it needed to be, and that he was going to make up his mind, and not just make up his mind, but then stick to what he had decided. Next, I want you to turn over to chapter 5. Chapter 5. So here, we see that Nebuchadnezzar had started reigning back in the... he finished reigning in about the 560s. He was one of the longest reigning kings for about 30 years, about 590s, 580s to the 560s. And this Belshazzar, by all accounts, is a grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. So it's been some time. And we're going to see that at the end of this passage that we're about to read is that, you know, the following day Belshazzar is going to be slain, and it's understood that he was killed in about 539 BC. And so all in all, it's about 60-some-odd years since what we just read about Daniel. So Daniel is getting up in age. And when all is said and done here, we're going to see Daniel has a choice to make. You'll start reading with me in verse 17. Daniel answered and said before the king, he's been asked to interpret this mysterious handwriting on the wall. Daniel answered and said before the king, keep your gifts for yourself or give your rewards to someone else. However, I will read the inscription to the king and make the interpretation known to him. O king, the Most High God granted sovereignty, grandeur, glory, and majesty to Nebuchadnezzar, your father. Because of the grandeur which he bestowed on him, all the peoples, nations, and men of every language feared and trembled before him. Whomever he wished, he killed, and whomever he wished, he spared alive, and whomever he wished to elevate, and whomever he wished, he humbled. But when his heart was lifted up, and his spirit became so proud that he behaved arrogantly, he was deposed from his royal throne, and his glory was taken away from him. He was also driven away from mankind, and his heart was made like that of beasts, and his dwelling place was with the wild donkeys. He was given grass to eat like cattle, and his body was drenched with the dew of heaven until he recognized that the Most High God is ruler over the realm of mankind, and that he sets over it whomever he wishes. Yet you, his son Belshazzar, have not humbled your heart, even though you knew all of this. But you have exalted yourself against the Lord of heaven, and they have brought the vessels of his house before you, and you and your nobles, your wives, and your concubines have been drinking wine from them. And you have praised the gods of silver and gold, of bronze, iron, wood, and stone, which do not see, hear, or understand. But the God in whose hand are your life, breath, and all your ways, you have not glorified. And so here, I know it says, father, your father. That was a pretty standard thing to say back then, even if it was a grandfather. So what he says here to Belshazzar is, look, there is a time in your grandfather's life whom my God humbled, and humbled greatly, and you know that, and yet it hasn't stuck with you. And then he's going to go on, starting in 24, in verse 24, of what the interpretation, what it actually says, the inscription and its interpretation. And then later that night, Belshazzar is going to be killed. But what we have to understand here is Daniel teaches us that it does not matter who you are. It doesn't matter who you are. The truth of God is timeless and regardless of position. And this is something that we let people of all kinds of situations intimidate us into not being very faithful, or at least not expressing our faith. Sometimes, like what we talked about this morning in Bible class about the evidence, right? We have a great preponderance of evidence to look at, and yet we'll let academics, just because they have a little DR in front of their name or a PhD at the end of their name, to dictate to us things about God. And that's not right. It doesn't matter who you are, the truth of God applies to you. And here he says, even Nebuchadnezzar, which people would have said even at this time, Nebuchadnezzar was by far the best ruler Babylon ever had. Even he knew this, and you have neglected it. And so now the kingdom was taken away from him. And Daniel, in his old age, he had to make a choice. Because it could have been like, you're just an old man, and we'll go ahead and execute you, and we don't have to worry about your drivel anymore. But he said, no, I need to tell you about this. He doesn't just interpret what was on the wall. He gives him a little lesson, a lesson that clearly he had forgotten. And so, even after all these years, Daniel seems to have kept something of his faith. That this faith that he showed before, that he had made decisions on, that he's sticking with even after all these years. And then when you look at chapter 6, we're going to see this even more, because Belshazzar is going to be slain, and then we see Darius the Mede come in. And we're not sure how long it is before this happens, but Darius decides, we're going to shake things up a little bit. We're going to have rulers over certain provinces, and then we're going to have rulers over them, and then me and everything will be just fine. Except it's not just fine for Daniel, and they try to find some sort of corruption in which they can get him deposed. However, Daniel seems not have any sort of corruption that they can find. Again, further proving that throughout his success and throughout his time, he clearly has not violated his faith by doing anything corrupt. Because by the lengths that they are prepared to go, it seemed like it'd be pretty easy to find some corruption that Daniel would be accused of. But verse 5 says, then these men said, we will not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God. I wish they could say that about me. The worst thing about you is that you worship God. And that's the worst thing that they can come up with. And so they come up with this plan, verse 10. They have the king sign it, that for 30 days no one can worship any god or man besides Darius. Then verse 10, when Daniel knew that the document was signed, he entered his house. Now in his roof chamber he had windows open toward Jerusalem. And he continued, kneeling on his knees 3 times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God, as he had been doing previously. And here that concept of having done previously denotes a long period of time. Daniel has been doing this for some time, and he's still continuing to do it, assuming it has been many, many years. And when all is said and done, he had made a decision and stuck with it. He made a decision that he would pray 3 times a day, giving thanks to God. And even now, when all of that is in jeopardy, he's going to do just that. But I want you to notice something here, something that's actually sort of apart from Daniel in a way. Notice here, I have verses 14 through 19. Let's read those, 14 through 19, chapter 6. Then as soon as the king heard this statement that he couldn't save Daniel, he was deeply distressed and set his mind on delivering Daniel. Excuse me, that he couldn't change the law. He set his mind on delivering Daniel, and even until sunset, he kept exerting himself to rescue him. Then these men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, "Recognize, O king, that it is a law of the Medes and Persians that no injunction or statute which the king establishes may be changed." Then the king gave orders, and Daniel was brought in and cast into the lion's den. The king spoke and said to Daniel, "Your God, whom you constantly serve, will himself deliver you." A stone was brought and laid over the mouth of the den. The king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signet ring of his nobles, so nothing will be changed in regard to Daniel. Then the king went off to his palace and spent the night fasting, and there was no entertainment that was brought before him, and his sleep fled from him. And then the king arose at dawn at the break of day and went in haste to the lion's den. Can you imagine that this Daniel, over all this time, over all the different people he's served under, that however long this has been, Darius knows two things. One, he is deeply concerned and has great care for Daniel. But also in verse 16, the God whom you constantly serve. He had been around Daniel to know at least that much, that Daniel constantly served God. Are there people in your life that can say the same thing about you? That's what they know about you? That you are constantly serving God? And because of who you are, they have great care for you. So my lesson for you, make God be the reason why you are punished. Don't be your own punishment. Because if we are suffering because of God, then there's nothing we can do about that. All that we have left for us is for God to bless us. If we are why we're being punished, that's a different issue. That means there are things that we need to fix. There are things that we need to change about ourselves, that we might be enemies with our God. But if we are being punished, if the best way to get to us is to punish us in regards to our religion, in our relationship to Christ, I say bring it on. I would rather that be why I'm punished than my own sinfulness. But this is what we have to think about in terms of our faith. Is your faith the kind of faith in which that's the only way people can seem to really get to you? Is through your faith. Turn over to the book of Nehemiah, Nehemiah chapter 2. Nehemiah chapter 2. When we're first introduced to Nehemiah, he's a little bit older than the first time we're introduced to Daniel. But here in Nehemiah chapter 2, we're going to read verses 1 through 8. And I want you to pick up on a couple of things here. Hopefully you will as we read through these. It came about in the month Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, that wine was before him. And I took up the wine and gave it to the king. Now I had not been sad in his presence. That's a big no-no for the wine for the wine taster to be sad in the king's presence. So the king said to me, "Why is your face sad, though you are not sick? This is nothing but sadness of heart." Then I was very much afraid. I said to the king, "Let the king live forever. Why should my face not be sad when the city, the place of my father's tombs, lies desolate and its gates have been consumed by fire?" Then the king said to me, "What would you request?" So I prayed to the God of heaven. I said to the king, "If it please the king, and if your servant has found favor before you, send me to Judah, to the city of my father's tombs, that I may rebuild it." Then the king said to me, the queen sitting beside him, "How long will your journey be, and when will you return?" So it pleased the king to send me, and I gave him a definite time. And I said to the king, if it please the king, let letters be given me for the governors of the provinces beyond the river, that they may allow me to pass through until I come to Judah. And a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber to make beams for the gates of the fortress, which is by the temple, for the wall of the city, and for the house to which I will go. And the king granted them to me because the good hand of God was on me. So, a couple of things I want us to have in mind here. The first is something similarly to what we saw with Daniel. Notice that instead of, which was typical, if you were sad in the king's presence as a wine tester, you were pretty much immediately beheaded because it was very suspicious. But that's not what Artaxerxes says here. He simply asks him, why are you sad? And then sort of gives him a reason, right? This is nothing but sadness of heart. And there's not just an immediate punishment given. He seems to genuinely care why Nehemiah is like this. And obviously Nehemiah is very trusted to be in the position that he's in. But then note the relationship that Nehemiah and the king actually have. When he asks Nehemiah this, Nehemiah, even despite his being afraid, is very plain with Artaxerxes. Why should my face not be sad when my land is burned, when my city is burned? It's a very bold statement to make, even for a wine taster. This is a very big deal for Nehemiah to make such a claim, because who's responsible? But the king doesn't seem offended. The king doesn't say, you know what, let's just deal with this right now. Let's just have you leave my presence. He says, what would you request? Then what can I do to help you? Can you imagine a man having that sort of influence? But then what does he do? What would you request? And then what does Nehemiah immediately do? He prays. Can you imagine taking a second, standing in front of a king, from all accounts that you have, the king of the entire world, and you're going to take time to pray in his presence after he's just asked you a question and is waiting for your response? And you're going to say, hold on a second, I need to pray about this. We always have time to pray. We always have time to commune with God. And we get so caught up in everything that we have to do that we're then suddenly surprised that God has been taking a proverbial back seat to our life. No matter what is going on in your life, you always have time to pray. But then, imagining who Nehemiah is, the position that he holds, the power and authority that he has, what is his response after he prays to God? I need to go and help. I need to go and do something about this. You are never in the wrong place to do the work of God. You are never in the wrong place. Because no matter where you are, no matter what you're doing, God is going to be able to use it. Because guess what? As he's leaving, it's only because of his influence that Nehemiah can even do the things that he needs to get done. Because the king that he serves has such authority to give him all the materials he needs, to give him the time that he needs, to give him the safety that he needs, at least on his travels. This is what Nehemiah has to do. And Nehemiah knows it. And the situation he's in, he does not let that be an excuse for why he's not doing what God expects him to do. And can you imagine then what he has to give up? A man being in that kind of position. You have family. You're settled. You are right where you need to be. Probably consider it home. And here Nehemiah says, I need to be elsewhere, at least for a time. And I need to give up what I have right now in order to do the work of God. Sometimes that's what God is going to ask of you. Is your faith where it needs to be to say, okay, I will do just that. And then if you turn with me to the book of Jeremiah. Jeremiah chapter 20. Jeremiah chapter 20. We're going to be reading verses 7 through 18. O Yahweh, you have deceived me and I was deceived. You have overcome me and prevailed. I have become a laughingstock all day long. Everyone mocks me. For each time I speak, I cry aloud. I proclaim violence and destruction, because for me the word of Yahweh has resulted in reproach and derision all day long. But if I say I will not remember him or speak any more in his name, then in my heart it becomes like a burning fire shut up in my bones, and I am weary of holding it in, and I cannot endure it. For I have heard the whispering of many, terror on every side. Denounce him, yes, let us denounce him. All my trusted friends watching for my fall say, perhaps he will be deceived, so that we may prevail against him and take our revenge on him. But Yahweh is with me like a dread champion. Therefore my persecutors will stumble and not prevail. They will be utterly ashamed because they have failed with an everlasting disgrace that will not be forgotten. Yet, O Yahweh of hosts, you who test the righteous, who see the mind and the heart, let me see your vengeance on them, for to you I have set forth my cause. Sing to Yahweh, praise Yahweh, for he has delivered the soul of the needy one from the hand of evildoers. Cursed be the day when I was born, let not the day be blessed when my mother bore me. Cursed be the man who brought the news to my father, saying, a baby boy has been born to you, and made him very happy. But let that man be like the cities which Yahweh overthrew without relenting, and let him hear an outcry in the morning and a shout of alarm at noon, because he did not kill me before birth, so that my mother would have been my grave and her womb ever pregnant. Why did I ever come from the womb to look on trouble and sorrow, so that my days have been spent in shame? Whew, no wonder there's a book called Lamentations written by this guy. Jeremiah, from what we understand, has always been an aged man. And here, he's realizing just what God has called him for. That no matter what he seems to try, no matter how he proclaims the word of Yahweh, the word of the Lord, he can't seem to get his message across. Nobody wants to listen. And so now he's looking at God and saying, okay, I'll get it now. Do you want me to do this? And not one person is listening to me. And where in what we just read does God give him an answer? God's answer to this prayer is, get up and go. And what does Jeremiah do? He gets up and he goes. I want you to go. We're going to go through this here. I'm going to pick up a couple of points here. He's exasperated in his situation, but he knows how central God is supposed to be to him. He says in verse 11, the Lord is with me. Yahweh is with me like a dread champion. They'll be utterly ashamed. If he tries not to speak the word of God, it says that it becomes a fire shut up in his bones. Can you imagine what that's like? That you, out of all the studying that you've done, out of all the spiritual knowledge that you have, that you can't keep it inside. That if you do, it would be a fire that consumes you and destroys you. Does your own evangelism ever feel like that? Does it feel like if I don't just tell somebody, I'm going to go crazy? If you don't have that zeal of some sort, I'll help you. I'll talk to you. Because that's the way it ought to be for us. That no matter what is going on in my life, I will always have the need to tell someone about God. And Jeremiah has been dealing with this for quite some time. As I said before, Jeremiah is kind of, as far as we understand, always an older man. And he's just dealing with this constantly. And finally, in his exasperation, he says, I just want it to stop. I just want to be able to not tell people. Because he's so tired of the outcome. Can you imagine telling so many people? And see, that's the problem, is a lot of times when we think about our evangelism, first of all, we tend to think of our evangelism as accosting random strangers at Walmart, and that's not really evangelism. We either think it's that or going door to door. How many doors need to be slammed in your face for you to start feeling like Jeremiah? Because I'll tell you, you probably haven't hit that number yet. You don't really understand what Jeremiah is going through. I don't really understand. I can sympathize, but I'm not sure I can really understand it either. But every time, when everything has finally gotten to him and he says, you know what, that's it, I'm done, that there is this little voice inside him that says, oh really? Oh really, you're done? Show me that you're done. You don't have to get back up off the mat. You've been knocked down too many times. It's fine. No, that's not what's going on in Jeremiah's mind. He can't get what he has to say out of his mind. He has to tell people about the Word of God. And it's not always pretty. In fact, it's almost never pretty what Jeremiah has to say. We are never too old. We are never too old to do the work of God. If you want a New Testament example of this, over in 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus, in both works there, in Timothy and Titus's books, Paul mentions about older people in congregations. He says, in fact, they're the ones who have the most responsibility. They're the ones who don't have a chance to sit back and be a spectator. They don't get the chance to say, I'm too old. That they're the ones that we're supposed to be looking up to. And that they're the ones that after a lifetime of serving God, they are like Jeremiah. They have been through this for so long that they really just want it to end and they can't bring themselves to do it. Can you imagine how encouraging that should be? To have someone who says, you know what, I've just always wanted it to just be over and I've never been able to bring myself to. I've had doors slammed in my face, I've lost friends, I've lost family, and yet I can't stop. Can you imagine having a faith like that? That despite your best efforts, you can't stop worshiping God and teaching others about God. And we better understand what this fire in our bones really is and what it really should be. I actually had made the choice to be a preacher quite a while ago. I was still going through college. I was probably a sophomore in college. And my father's a preacher, for those of you who don't know. And so I went and I spoke to Dad, and Dad said, "Andrew, I really just have one question." I said, "Okay, shoot." He said, "Can you think of any reason why you would not tell someone about God?" I sat there for a second and said, "Yeah, I guess I can see some situations where it may not be the best idea." And he kind of sat there for a second and he said, "Then I don't think you're ready to be a preacher." And I sat there for a minute. I said, "You know what? I think you're right." And I got off that track for a few years. And I say a few years, probably 2 or 3 years later, it came back up to me. And I thought, you know, this is something that I really need to do. And I went to my dad a second time. He says, "I can't really say I'm surprised that you're back about this." And he sat me down and we studied through Jeremiah. That was all we did. Thankfully, I was home for the summer. It took a month and a half. But we went through every day through Jeremiah. He said, "Because son, this is what you have to deal with." He said, "You want to know the really sad thing?" He said, "The people who treated Jeremiah the way they treat him were non-believers. There are going to be believers that treat you that way." The ultimate point, though, about Jeremiah is that not once does Jeremiah ever actually stop preaching. Not once does Jeremiah say, "You know what? I really am out of the game. I really am done. I've hit the floor too many times." He's breast deep in wells. He's taken places he doesn't want to go. He's constantly spit on and mocked and jeered. And he can't bring himself to stop, as much as he might want to. I'm not saying that y'all have to be preachers, but the point is still there. Because we all are supposed to be in our own way. Not all, actually very little evangelism is actually done up here. It's one of the worst Christian misconceptions. Jill and I used to be a teacher at the school that Jill taught for. She taught there longer than I did. And and as I was getting ready to start the school year, I said, "You know, all right, babe, what's your wisdom for me?" And she said, "You just need to be aware that teaching is probably about 25% of your job. The rest of the job is something else." And I said, "Oh, okay, I'm going to be honest, I didn't quite believe her." And I got into it, and that was true. It was about 25% of my job. And one day, we were getting to mid-year, you know, it was Christmas break, and I was leaving my classroom, and I turned around. The way I'd set up my classroom was tables instead of desks, so they were kind of in a U shape. They could all look at me. And I realized that it looked a lot like what I had going on at the church that I was preaching for at the time. And it occurred to me that that's the same up here for preachers. This is 25% of the job, maybe, tops. It's 25% of the job. And Michael and I and whoever else has had experience preaching, we sit and we study and we talk to people. We talk up here. We lecture all day. But the other 75% of the work is actually you. And it's us trying to convince you of that. You are supposed to be this. This isn't me. This is you. And that has to be what your faith is. Is that right there. And you know what? If you're young, younger than me, I'm 26, then Daniel is your lesson. Make your choices now. Because you're going to be challenged at the end of your life. Make your decisions now. You might have a lion's den to deal with. Goodness gracious, I feel like I've already had to deal with them. And I'm only 26. You might have to deal with them. You get to a little bit older. If you've made that decision, then you're going to recognize the times where you might have to leave what's comfortable. That you might have to go somewhere you weren't expecting to go and do the work that God has asked of you. And then when you come to your old age, if you're doing what you ought to, you're still going to have trials. Because if you're sitting in your old age and thinking, all right, it's just coasting from here to the end, no, it ain't. We never coast. As much as we might want to, that's not the way this life is. You are either accelerating or you are decelerating. There is no in between. And hopefully you caught on to that as we went through. I know I might have thrown you off a little bit, giving you an episode of Daniel's older life. But Daniel in his youth made a choice. Nehemiah in the middle of his life had to make a choice. And Jeremiah in his old life had to make a choice. And the choice was all the same. The choice was to uphold the faith that they had been building. To uphold their relationship with God. Because that's ultimately what your faith is. It's a relationship with God. It's not something abstract. So you have to be building that right now. And if you're not doing that, then you're really missing out and you're really setting yourself up for failure in your later life. And if some of you who are more experienced in years are finding some of this too, I wish I had made the choice when I was younger. You still have time to make a choice. You still have time to decide right now. Now is the time to work on your faith. Now is the time to work on your love and your compassion. Now is the time to work on what you have with God. As the saying goes, you can sleep when you're dead. And we have no time to rest when it comes to us and our faith. So hopefully these three men have been lessons for you. Hopefully they've helped you come to a better understanding of what your faith needs to be. But just remember that your faith is yours. We can help each other. We can strengthen each other's faith. But your faith and your relationship with God is your own. And you have to be building on it. I can help you, but it still comes from you. So this afternoon, we're going to sing a song. And while we're singing that song, that gives you an opportunity. It gives you an opportunity to build your faith. Build your faith up more. Maybe start building it. Maybe you haven't started building it yet. And I would highly recommend you do so. These men had plenty to get in their way. And at the end of the day, they didn't let him. They didn't let these things get in their way. And you can't either. So take advantage of this opportunity because tomorrow is this great lie that we love to tell ourselves. I always have tomorrow. No, you don't. You don't even have the next hour, let alone tomorrow. And I can tell you, I'm an excellent procrastinator. But you can't just keep waiting. Because the problem with procrastinators is when we know the deadline. That's the problem. We know the deadline. You don't know the deadline. So you can't procrastinate. You have no option to do that. So don't lie to yourself and say, tomorrow I'll get it done. No, you won't. Because tomorrow, you'll say tomorrow. And tomorrow's false. Tomorrow is a lie in and of itself. Because once tomorrow comes, what is it? It's today. It is always today. So take advantage of this opportunity, please, as we stand and as we sing.